Welcome back, everybody, to Arts About. I'm Sally Bailiu, and you're listening to Arts About, brought to you by the generosity of the McClelland Sculpture Park and Gallery and facilitated by the Bendigo Bank Studio. This is a very special show because it's coming to you from the past. John and I have decided to have a few weeks off during the holidays, and so to prevent you all from deserting us, we've been compiling a few extra interviews in the weeks preceding Christmas for our technical producer Brody to compile and send out to you while we lounge about on banana lounges and slap on sunscreen. As well as the odd recent interview, there'll be a few oldies as well that we think deserve another airing, and there might also be the odd Will and Dr. Gabe too, which personally I think are some of the best work we've done, or they have at least. And I miss that they're not so regular these days because Dr. Gabe is so busy. Hope you enjoy them. There'll be some music too that we've selected over the years and perhaps even the odd John on. We've been doing this now for nearly 4 years, so there's plenty of material for Brody to play with. I hope it's entertaining and you're interested and it keeps you listening to us while the summer passes. We'll be back in person and answerable again at the end of January. In the meantime, enjoy the mixture. As I mentioned, maybe it was last week, I can't exactly remember, but John and I went along to the media launch of the Andy Warhol Ai Weiwei exhibition with our esteemed academic friend, Dr. Gary Willis. Good morning, Gary. How are you this morning?
Good morning, Sally B.
Yeah, great.
Excellent, yeah.
So Gary's joined us on the line today to, we thought we would just ruminate a little on what we saw the other day.
And it was very interesting, I thought, all of that. You know, Andy Warhol, I think I've found a new interest in Andy Warhol, partly because of the show at the NGV, but also because of the documentary that was on the TV at about the same time.
Yes. Wasn't that fabulous, that documentary?
Yeah.
Mm. The shift, there's a massive shift that happens after the shooting, after he gets shot in the stomach by Valerie Solanas.
That's right.
And the implications of that are enormous, I think, because he makes that shift from sort of representing what he calls the hippie culture, you know, all of his drag queen friends and, you know, sort of stoned freakoids. And then suddenly he sort of pulls back and the doors to the factory get sort of closed and
he essentially goes into business doesn't
art.
He?
Mm. Yeah.
And even more closely to what he was doing, I think he almost proudly displayed the scarring that resulted and at least with the same sort of interest that he applied to car accident victims and those other sort of the gory stuff that he was into for a little while there. And he had, they were terrific scars.
Oh, yeah.
But tell me, what did you both think about the, I mean, in the very first place, the assertion that Max Delaney and Tony Elwood have made by putting these two artists together is to make a comparison between them. And although in many ways they're very, very different artists, it was clear through that exhibition that there were similarities. What do you two think about that?
I think that they are both in their own way what could be thought of as history painters or history artists. They're dealing with their own contemporary history and in a very elegant and thoughtful way, you know. I think they're both very good at what they do, but they're both also very disturbing in the way that they go about it. In other, you know, there are other parts of their practice, both of them, that I find a little disturbing, and other parts that I find a bit tedious. You know, you need a bit of tedium to keep you going, I reckon.
Yeah, you can't be good all the time. Yeah. You've got to do a few bad ones to get it, you know, to make room for the good ones. Mm. I sort of see them both as almost legacy of Duchamp in some way or another. You know, the sort of not just the ready-made, but that kind of a poet concrete shift from the preoccupations of painting, etc., into the account. When I look at Warhol now, I think that guy had he was just almost documenting all of his people, all of his time, all of everything that went on in his world just simply got accounted for. So it's a practice of radical account for his own culture. That's how I think of it.
Right.
And, you know, that by any means necessary, I mean, you name it, he did it, film, audio, Polaroids, prints, you know, he just documenting everything that moved in his own little world, and the more extreme, the better.
Mm. Does Ai Weiwei do the same thing?
Not not in the same way, but it's a much. He's got a much bigger platform to sort of operate on, and also he seems to deal with the socio-political critique of what's happening in his culture in China in all sorts of ways. I mean, there's some stunning things like the, just the feet of smashed Buddhas, you know, coming out of the Cultural Revolution, all the Buddhas who, you know, the sort of the life-size Buddhas who've been carved out of stone have been smashed off, and he's collected just the feet of those things. Mm. These sorts of things go on and on, and they're extraordinary.
Yeah, I think with Ai Weiwei, you know, he's appropriated certain objects, but he is, in addition to actually just documenting his time, I think he's also making great criticism, isn't he?
Plenty of it, you know. Yeah. He's sticking his finger up at a lot of things, yeah. It would seem. Yeah.
Yes. That's the signature, in fact, sticking his finger up at it. Yeah. I mean, you can get the umbrella.
Yeah. Well, I did get the umbrella. And the other thing I got, which I thought was really fabulous, was there are travel spoons.
Oh, really?
There's Ai Weiwei travel spoons with that finger up in front of the Eiffel Tower and in front of the White House.
And missed
so
those.
I got those.
What, the complete set, the globalised set.
No, yeah. Terrific. And the other thing that was really interesting, it wasn't what I expected at all, but we've all heard here, of course, in Melbourne, the call out for all the Lego pieces. And Lego's refusal to supply Ai Weiwei with those Lego pieces.
Didn't realize that.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was why there was you know, the call out was for people to bring along their Lego to the art center, and there's a room in there that has been constructed entirely of Lego, sort of the inner sanctum in one of the gallery spaces, with some political messages up on the walls. There's Julian Assange and there's Rosie Beatty and
Cheryl Overs.
Yes, there
Gary
were.
Gary Foley, both worthy of mention.
Which was really interesting because, you know, as well as having an opinion and documenting what's going on in China, he's making world references and he's making very local references here to us.
Bringing people forward out of, you know, bringing spokespeople. I mean, it's interesting. If you were an Australian artist looking at that sort of stuff, to, you know, who would you choose? That might be an interesting question. Who would you choose, you know, to bring forward as a sort of somewhat neglected socio-political voice within our own culture?
You know. Clearly, Gary.
Well, you know, it's good to see Gary Foley in there. I mean, yeah. You know, I think he's very important because he's very articulate about and he's got a lot to say. Cheryl Overs, do you know much about Cheryl Overs?
No.
No.
Either of you? No. I think she came out of. I'm not the historian on her culture, but I met her in London, and she's come out of the sexual rights issues. And I think she was a sort of working in Europe for the AIDS Council, I think. And I remember traveling to South America, attending something like 5 conferences on cross transsexual practices that are trying to sort of develop AIDS prevention programs with these people.
Oh,
you know, traveling
really?
With armed bodyguards, with you know, machine gun, you know, on either side of her. So it's like she's lived a scary life, that girl. But so, it's interesting that she's Australian.
So listen, tell me, what would you say were your lasting impressions, or perhaps even just a recommendation to people about that exhibition? Gary.
Oh, there's. I love the balloon room. I mean, there's both Ai Weiwei with his Twitter feed balloons, but also the original Warhol room with the cow wallpaper. There's massed balloons. It's almost as if it's a sort of perfect thing. It's a bit like being there in its original moment. And there's certainly some other really great classic pieces.
Yeah, they most certainly
are. I have to say, for myself, I'm a big fan of Andy Warhol on Mao Zedong. I just think that they're terrific. And I know that you and I enjoyed the big column that had pierced a table by Ai Weiwei.
Stunning, yes.
And the level of craftsmanship was really quite apart from anything else, the level of craftsmanship involved was really quite remarkable. And also, for the same reasons, the sort of crippled axe in a case, you know.
Oh, wasn't that gorgeous? Yes.
Yeah, it was a beautiful thing.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it was a very special day. We were very lucky, and we were treated to a conversation with Ai Weiwei and Tony Earwood. And I'm going to put a photograph up. In fact, I probably put a few of them, actually, of us all there at the exhibition. But the one sort of resounding memory in my head is of standing up on the balcony and looking at this very humble man. He was beautifully gently spoken and really
humble,
gorgeous.
Humble.
Yeah, standing in front of his 468 bicycles that have all been interlocked together and fronted by this phalanx of press. It was really, really spectacular.
Out of the way, Gary. TV coming through.
That's right.
Yeah. Look, it's on for some time at the National Gallery. It's really worth having a look. It's quite surprising, yeah, the parallels of these two artists. And it's absolutely stunning, the enormity of the work. There's so much stuff in there. There's something that you will love. There's something that you will recognise. It's really terrific. And at some point, I hope, we'll get Max Delaney, who's one of the curators, in to talk about it. Thanks for talking to us today, Gary Willis.
Pleasure. Thank you, Sally and John.
Thanks, Gary.
Well, this is just a little bit unusual. I'm standing here with Dr. Gabe North, and we're not standing in the city or out the front of Brunelli's or Brunetti's cafe, somewhere like that, up in the place where she normally is. We're actually in New South Wales. Dr. Gabe North has convinced me to spring the RPP combi van out of the garage in Mornington, and we have driven through the afternoon yesterday up through Albury, through a little town called Howlong, and last night we were at the Corowa Country Club, which has reciprocal rights, of course, with Radio 3RPP in Mornington, and that was very comfortable. Chicken in a basket, it's like the old days.
Oh, the smell of a country pub. It's been a long time for me too, Will. As you imagine, I spend most of my time in an urban environment. So to be able to tuck into that steak last night, the porterhouse with the garlic butter, sensational.
It's very old-fashioned. But look, all that's very comfortable, and I'm sure that the accountants at RPP will be very happy that we're up here filling the tanks and continuing our way. But you better tell me, why have you dragged me all the way to this little spot on the side of the road? There's some old farm buildings just here. Tell me why we're here.
Quite frankly, I'm furious. I was listening to the Arts About program the other day and heard our artist in residence, John Baird, refer to a Michael Lunick image called Ramming the Shears as one of the only pieces of art that he found hilarious. And that particular work of Lunig's has a very, very serious intent behind it, Will. So I needed to bring you out here to give you some context and to have a chat about it.
Well, I'm glad you take this sort of thing seriously, because this has been a couple of days out of my busy schedule. And where are we standing? What is this building that you've brought me to out in the middle of nowhere?
Well, we're in the heartland of the Riverina, about a 100 mile from Wagga, very close to an area that was the site of the Tom Roberts painting, which is known as Shearing the Rams, and that station was called Brocklesby.
Brocklesby Station. That painting, Shearing the Rams, I think is in the National Gallery, isn't it? It's quite a large painting.
Yes, it was actually Tom Roberts' intent that it would be an NGV acquisition. He was hoping for some big bickies when he actually rendered the painting between 1888 and 1889. He was here in this area at that time. He was taking photographs. He was doing some charcoal sketches and doing some plein air in preparation for Shearing the Rams.
Why don't we step inside? This is the shearing shed that we're coming to now. We've just got to cross over this little grate here. Just be careful of your shoes. And we'll go in, just open the gate, and we'll step inside. This is a rather fabulous old shearing. Oh, wow, look inside here. This is just spectacular. Some of these old, I'll just close this gate. I don't know if there's any sheep going to rush in. Probably not. This is fabulous. Look at the atmosphere in here. You can see these posts in the middle of the shed. Actually, these look like they've just been cut from entire trees. They're holding the whole structure up.
I particularly like the Lysart orb on the ceiling. It's a sensational part of Australian architecture, isn't it?
It is. It's all part of our wonderful history of architectural history in rural stuff, which was the shearing sheds and outbuildings that were built on stations around the country. But I want to know more about being inside this shed. We'll talk a little bit about the shed perhaps later.
Yes, indeed. What's important, of course, is that we stay on message, which is about the profound thread, the link that links contemporary artists all the way back through the Renaissance and further on to Egypt, as Brett Whiteley said. And there is certainly a lot of that going on that begins here, the ignition point being Tom Roberts Shearing the Rams, which was later reinterpreted by Michael Lunig as Ramming the Shears. But believe it or not, there is even a little Renaissance touch in Tom Roberts' original work, but we'll get to that later, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, I'm looking around and I'm seeing all these wonderful things inside this shed. I don't know if this is still a current shearing shed or not. Looks as though it is. There's machinery up here. I know the painting, I know Shearing the Rams, and that shed, I know that the shearers are working manually with hand shears rather than the steam-powered and then electric-powered shears. So that may be something else that you wanted to mention about Tom Roberts, why he may have taken that line. In here we can see the various shafts and spindles and pulleys and things that were quite dangerous in their day, but they plug in and that's where they shear, over on that wall over there.
Well, you're very clever to pick up on the fact that at the time that Shearing the Rams was painted, there had just been the recent introduction in the Riverina of mechanised forms of sheep shearing, and Roberts deliberately chose not to do that, to show that in his picture. He shows very hard-working labourers at the task of shearing the rams using the traditional method, and he does that because he is idealising labour methods and showing how things were done during what's probably considered a golden age and was certainly called the long boom, where Australia was the biggest exporter of wool to UK and Europe at that particular time. And in fact, by the time Shearing the Rams was painted, we were at the end of that long boom and unfortunately in a period of decline leading into the First World War. So what Tom Roberts is doing here is replicating a golden age of Australian labour.
That is true, that's for sure. Looking around here, this is mechanised shed, but it may not have been back then. I wonder if this was the original shed that was shown in that painting, do you think?
I'm afraid no. Brocklesby Station, the shearing shed, the famous shearing shed, actually burnt down. It was originally, this is the site though, that was originally owned by an ancestor of Hamilton Hume. And apparently there is some link to Roberts, who spent time in 1888 and 1889 here, I think through to September and December of those years, trying to capture this particular image the way he wanted it. It was certainly done, and when we talk about the profound thread, it was done not in what we consider to be the impressionist style of the period that you see in his peers in Streeton or McCubbin. It was done in a way that paid homage to the style of realism in Europe and the UK at the time. And when you think of images like Jules Bastien Lepage's The Potato Gatherers, which is here at the NGV, it's this beautiful, almost there's a photorealism about it, but it makes the common labouring person heroic, which when you think of it, you can remember a lot of Van Gogh pictures that did something very similar.
Well, I'm glad that he was making them heroic, because I think shearers renowned for hard workers, but I just wonder, looking at the painting, they're all males. There is one female in that painting, which is interesting. Right in the middle, there is a young girl. We're just going to walk further over. I see you've got your sensible shearing shoes on. We're going to walk over here to the other side, where there's some magnificent stencils on the wall.
It totally smells in here, which I'm finding offensive, but I'll continue with it on as long as you can stand it, I can stand it.
Well, I love that smell because it's the smell of the lanolin from the wool, and you can get that out of these boards that we're walking on now. And up here on the wall, these stencils that you can see up here, obviously been put there by the shearers. There's some names there. There's actually there's more numbers than names, so they may well be referring to the numbers of sheep that were done or records that were held. They've been stenciled on there, and there are some stencils with a bee on them, so I'm wondering if that was Brockle's bee, but you never know. I guess if it's not the original shed, perhaps later on they used this shed.
Maybe you're right.
Now I'm just moving further into here. I'm interested in the fact that it was a totally male place. Even the cooks were male. There were no females at all. In the painting there is one female though, which is interesting, right in the middle of the picture.
Well, Roberts was a man who was a practitioner of plein air painting, and he did use a female model, a young girl who was the daughter of the squatter in the painting. So you do see her depicted there, albeit in a masculine sense. But I think it's funny. I think if there's one criticism that I have of my peers in art interpretation is that there is now a feminist theory of the work that says that Tom Roberts deliberately chose the shearing session where only rams were being shorn rather than ewes. So where is the feminine representation on the land? Which I think, to be honest, the lesbians are getting a little carried away with themselves with that one.
Yeah, that might be a little bit of a stretch. I got my own theories on that, but these stencils and the insides of the shed, quite apart from the Tom Roberts painting, they remind me of Rosalie Gascoigne's work, and you wonder, she's no longer with us, of course, but you wonder whether she was influenced by it shows human interaction with things and stuff and with the machinery that was used and with the woodwork, the lining boards, the floorboards here, these lanolin filled boards. You can actually, if I kick them around like that, you can actually smell the sheep fat coming out of those boards.
Yeah, it's totally gross. The thing that I don't think we should do is fall into the same trap possibly that Roberts fell into, Will, which was to make these moleskinned Arcadians, if you like, to be these romantic heroes. It was very tough work and it was very hard work. And in fact, the picture that Lunig did of ramming the shears is actually a comment about that our earliest renderings that we see as truly Australian actually are a myth. And what Lunig's picture, which depicts a squatter ramming those shears up the shearer, is because that was exactly how they were treated at the time. I mean, we're only 100 miles from Wagga, which was the heartland of the union movement for the shearers at the time. They were governed by what was known as the Masters and Servants Act at the time. They were treated dreadfully. They worked maybe 4 or 5 months of the year. Many of them in the off-season would literally just wander out into the bush and perish. When they ate barely the food that a pig would have, and they were treated dreadfully. And Lunig's latest work on ramming the shears is actually attempting to redress the imbalance of the heroicness of the Roberts picture.
That's great. Well, we're going to have to move on, I guess, because we've come in here. I wondered also whether you, I mean, the shearers were all males. They all drank a lot, I know that. They weren't supposed to drink on the job, but they did. They slept in dormitories. They were exhausted. I've got a picture in my mind of all kinds of odd things that might have happened back then. I don't know how you fixed to give us a bit of an insight on alcoholism and homosexuality.
Oh, I'm sure it was rampant. But, I mean, at the end of the day, the people in that painting could not have possibly have been impervious to what was going on between the unionised shearers and the squattocracy at the time. And there's this beautiful response from Henry Lawson, who, when he saw the painting, he had this beautiful little phrase, and I'll read it to you now if I can. It says, we read about the drovers and the shearers and the like, till we wonder why such happy and romantic fellows strike. And at the end of the day, early artists tended to romanticise the workforce, those chaps that were wearing the chesty bond singlets known as the wife beaters. They did very, very hard work, and it shouldn't be forgotten that it wasn't all exactly Arcadia out here in the Riverina.
That's been a fascinating story, and of course a lot of us know that particular painting and kind of don't tend to read so much into it, but I might go back and have another look when I get back.
Well, when you do, make sure you look at the figure at the bottom left-hand side of the picture plane, which has a young boy. You see him mostly from the rear holding a sheepskin, and it's interesting that that particular figure is taken by Roberts from Ghiberti's figure of Esau, which is on the gates of paradise at the baptistry in Florence, just outside the Duomo. So as we've contended all along, Will, there is definitely a profound thread that links all of our artists back to their predecessors.
And I guess it's the same thread that's going to lead us back to the Corowa Country Club, where I might try the pepper steak tonight and you might have the chicken in a basket. But then we'll take the trusty RPP combi van back to the garage in Mornington, and we'll have to catch up with you again next week. Thank you very much, Dr. Gabe North.
It's a pleasure.
And now it's time for John On.
His engagement in the world of equestrian dressage.
And snake handling too, I'm
snake
going to
handling.
Add to that. Yes,
yeah,
I am.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mentioned at the top of the show Louis Kahn.
Yes.
And you, at least, I'm sure, Sally, will remember that in the past I've spoken about Louis Sullivan, the great American architect.
Yep.
And the inventor of the term form follows function.
Mm-hmm.
He brought something to architecture, which we spoke about. Louis Kahn brought something, I think, completely different, which is that he was into domestic architecture and that kind of the sort of architecture where you would take a cube and push another cube into it and produce a whole new shape and build a house within it and that kind of thing. Mm. Then he went to Europe on a tour. So he's doing that as a fairly young man.
What age are we talking? What
mid-20th century.
Right.
And he went to Europe to have a look at, I would imagine, Renaissance architecture in Europe, which was the big influence on American architecture for a long time, and he needed to go and have a look at that. And he came back with an entirely different view. In fact, he'd spent a lot of time looking at Roman ruins, that kind of stuff, the textures that they produce and the shapes that they produce, particularly the arch. And the arch in Roman architecture was all about holding buildings up and holding waterways up and that sort of thing. Kahn took that on board and he used it in a completely different way. And I was showing you that image earlier,
yes,
of
which is a remarkable
the side of a building in Dakar, which is brickwork, and it's got large circles all the way down the side of a walkway. And beyond that, there are sort of semicircles, both top and bottom, and then beyond that, more circles. So looking through it and out into the world from inside the building, you get the feeling that you're in fact gazing across a field of Roman viaducts.
Yes, and clearly with that photograph too, he must have been playing with light.
Light, shade, obviously.
Shadows.
Light
and,
yeah. And all of the shapes that shapes make when they're repeated, essentially, was what was going on. But he said that whilst Louis Sullivan and his lot were interested in the way the building performed as a building, how you could build it, they wanted height and they wanted, you know, more space per ground footage. And that's what they were interested in doing. People like Frank Lloyd Wright was interested in the way the building would, a house particularly, would work for the people who were living within it.
Mm.
So it was kind of an architecture from the inside.
Mm.
And Louis Kahn was very much interested in the way pedestrians reacted to his work. So people who were walking past it were, as far as he was concerned, they were his client. They were the people.
So it's almost more like a sculptor's point of view.
Very much sculptural. Yes. And the effect of all of it, I think, has been Louis Kahn pretty well brought us the architecture of brutality. The way other architects responded to it was with a lot of concrete, a lot of formwork, a lot of curves, a lot of circles within the concrete shapes, and all of which for me is just fabulous because I've always...
You love all those brutalism, don't you?
I do. I adore it all.
You miss the gas and fuel building, I seem to remember.
I do miss the gas and fuel building, although not for its brutalism, more for its international style.
Right, yes, okay.
And... Kahn also left a huge volume of drawings behind him, like Corbusier and Louis Sullivan as well, just reams and reams and reams of drawings. And I sort of wanted to point out that if people are interested in looking at Louis Kahn drawings, the internet's a great place to go to, and you'll find that, like all of those architects, he made a lot of drawings that had nothing to do with the client, nothing to do with the possibility of anything being built. In fact, they were just drawings of his own ideas in architecture with no thought of them being developed. And some of the ideas are absolutely glorious. You know,
Are they? And so Kahn is K-A-H-N, anybody wants to Google him. He sounds amazing. I might put that photograph up on our Facebook page because it's really beautiful.
And one wonders, or I wonder at least, where is the point that an architectural drawing departs from architecture and becomes fine art? You know, and I'm going to ponder on that for a little while.
John.
I doubt whether I'll ever come up with an answer for you. So.
Well, thanks for that anyway.
Many highly accomplished individuals from far and wide can be found holidaying on the peninsula over Christmas. The season brings many a Hugh Jackman sighting, and even Kylie pops up now and then. Not that any of these popinjays are nearly as interesting and as informed as today's VIP visitor. He's the author of four books on the English Renaissance, and countless articles and chapters ranging in subject from Shakespeare to T.S. Eliot, Hardy, the poet Larkin, and the painter Ian Fairweather. He has spoken at conferences from the Czech Republic to Japan and is regularly called upon for comment on all of the above. He is Professor of English Literature at the University of Queensland and, get this, Director of the University of Queensland's Node of the Australian Research Council's Centre of Excellence for the History of Emotions, Europe, 1100 to 1800. He is Professor Peter Holbrook, and he stands before me in a pair of distinctly non-academic rip curl boardies. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Peter.
I'm sorry about that extremely long introduction. I've used up a whole side of a C90 cassette on that one. Before we begin, I might just quickly describe our locale because it's certainly worth describing, isn't it, Peter?
This is an absolutely beautiful spot.
I mean, trees on both sides of a very long garden as a windbreak, lovely soft lawn, and islands of pampas and the dreaded pandanus reaching all the way down to that lovely path to the water.
It's a very pastoral spot.
Yes, now look, I'm sorry to butt in on your Shoreham sabbatical, but I couldn't resist the chance to add some more intellectual rigour to our show. I hope you're listening, John and Cliff. And Peter, I'd like to start by just getting you to tell us what is meant by the English Renaissance.
Well, Renaissance, of course, means rebirth. The English Renaissance, I think, needs to be understood as part of an international movement, beginning somewhat earlier in Italy and France than in England, which essentially involves the rediscovery of classical sources. Quite literally, it means the rediscovery of important manuscripts from the world of ancient Greece and Rome. So when you have people, for example, in Italy, like Petrarch, rediscovering some of these manuscripts and editing them and copying them, and eventually these manuscripts are published across Europe, a whole new intellectual universe is opened up, a universe that is very unfamiliar in many ways to 16th century Christians. And so what is opened up by that rediscovery of classical Greek and Roman philosophy, literature, eloquence in general, is, I think, a way of understanding human experience, which is not essentially Christian. So this is one of the aspects of the English Renaissance, or of the Renaissance in general, that you've got two paradigms, as it were, for understanding human beings. You've got the Judeo-Christian heritage, which of course is embodied in various forms of national faith throughout Europe, and you've got a pagan, classical line of inquiry and thought and speculation. And these two things come together in this extraordinary melting pot or fusion of intellectual and artistic traditions, which we know as the Renaissance, and which in England takes place roughly from, let's say, the late 16th century through to where we ended is a bit of a matter of speculation, but perhaps even into the early 18th century.
So are we talking Elizabethan England right in the middle of that period?
Absolutely, yeah. And the thing about Elizabethan England, and this is the other factor that we need to bring into play here, when I talk about Christendom in the Renaissance, I'm really talking, and historians are really talking about many Christendoms, because of course Christianity and the world of the universal Catholic Church is split down the middle with the emergence of the Protestant reforming movement. Initially, of course, with Martin Luther in Germany, but this is rapidly spreads across the continent. And the extraordinary thing about England during this period is that it goes through a number of confessional transformations. So the first break with universal Christendom, as embodied by the Pope of Rome, as the Protestants came to think of him, not in fact as the universal leader of the Christian world, but merely as a particular ecclesiastical politician, begins with Henry VIII's break from Rome. And extraordinary thing about England in this period is that it goes through a number of regime changes, as it were, in terms of confession and belief. So the Renaissance involves extraordinarily intense religious conflict over the true meaning of the scriptures and the true meaning of the Christian message. On the one hand, Catholics, loyal to the old religion. On the other hand, numerous varieties of Protestant belief, many of which are in tension or conflict with each other and in conflict with the old religion. And this is the world that I think is the ground for this extraordinary traffic in ideas and speculation and belief. In other words, you've got various ways of understanding the human condition. You can return to the thinkers and writers of the pre-Christian Greek and Roman world, or you've got many people within the Christian world who themselves can't agree with each other on the true meaning of the Christian religion.
So things are really bubbling up, quite a ferment, you might say.
Yes, this is a period of intense ideological, political, religious conflict, and as part of that, of intellectual conflict. Numerous philosophies are revived from the ancient world, skepticism, stoicism, Epicureanism. And these ancient Greek and Roman philosophies are non-Christian. They provide different ways of, as I say, understanding the human condition. And of course, you've also got theologians and believers of one stripe or another also in conflict with each other. And so this is a terribly conflicted and messy intellectual scene. But I think that's part of its vitality, because you've got people thinking about, as I say, the human experience from a whole range of different angles.
Well, I was just going to say, out of chaos and disarray, you get opportunity, don't you?
You do. You do. I think what you get is intellectual and artistic creativity. And I think we see that in the best of the writers of the English Renaissance. I say writers because it's my opinion, and I don't think I'd be alone in feeling this, that the really great creative energy of this period flows into literature rather than, in England, into the visual arts, though I'm not expert on that area. That's just my judgment, that I don't think most people would say, with apart from a few exceptions, for example, the painters of English miniatures like Hilliard, the really great achievement of the English Renaissance is in the visual arts or the plastic arts. It's really more in the art of the written word.
And perhaps I could be so bold, more specifically the plays of the time.
Absolutely. This is a golden age of writing for the theatre. It's a golden age of writing for a theatre which is intensely word conscious. I mean, we tend to think of theatre I think, as much a visual medium these days, perhaps a medium more akin to film than a medium devoted to the written word. But in the time of Shakespeare and other great dramatists, Ben Jonson, Webster, Middleton, and the list goes on and on, these are people who are trained rigorously in the arts of language. And this is a theatre in which spectators are as frequently known as auditors as they are spectators. These are people, in other words, who come to the theatre to listen to what the language is capable of.
So, Peter, where were these arts of language acquired?
Well, they were acquired through a very rigorous education system. And we mustn't ever forget that one of the institutions which is most responsible for the great works of Shakespeare and co., all of the other writers of that period, I'm talking here really of the middle of the 16th into the 17th century, one of the institutions that makes this possible is the school. Shakespeare went to a very good school. He didn't go to university, but he went to the King Edward VI Grammar School in Stratford-upon-Avon, where he was taught by some very well-educated, Oxford-trained tutors. And the curriculum of the grammar school in this period was essentially formed around the study of Latin authors. So Shakespeare was exposed to the best gold standard, dramatic and poetic writing of the ancient Roman world, Ovid.
Plutarch.
Plutarch, of course. Well, Plutarch eventually becomes one of Shakespeare's main sources for his plays. So people sometimes wonder, well, how did Shakespeare, you know, this boy from a provincial town, how could he ever have written these extraordinary works? Well, the answer is that he went to a good school, and you don't learn to become a good writer unless you're a good reader, I believe. So we have to thank the wonderfully rigorous education system that Shakespeare was subjected to. It wouldn't have been a very pleasant experience. These were not necessarily a very happy place, involving, for example, corporal punishment. But
bring it back, I say.
Well, it certainly worked in his case. There's another aspect of all this, too. People often comment on the intellectual vitality of the plays of this period. In other words, the plays are often set up as debates. You know, whose side are we on in Antony and Cleopatra? On the side of Rome or on the side of Egypt? Who do we support in the play Henry V? Do we think Henry V is a great hero, or is he a kind of war criminal, as some critics have argued? This reminds us that the plays are often structured as debates between large themes of the kind that I just mentioned, and the schooling system privileged the debate as a mode of instruction. So Shakespeare, along with other grammar school pupils, was required to develop a case for a particular topic. So it might be, for example, is day better than night? Or is night better than day? And you would have to argue the pro and contra of that. Now, these exercises are intended to train boys, they were mainly boys, in the arts of eloquence, which would be useful if they were to pursue a public career.
So we can all be very grateful for Shakespeare's thorough educational grounding.
You've been listening to a summer version of Arts About, a compilation of interviews we pre-recorded last year and some past highlights to keep you amused while we have a break. If you've only just tuned in, you can catch up on the show via podcast, which should appear on the station website sometime tomorrow, or hear us repeated on air and streaming Wednesdays at 12 after Secrets to Health with Angela Jacobson. We'll be back behind the mics in person at the end of the month, but in the meantime, remember, we may not know everything about art, but we know what we like.